From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, we'll speak with the new director of the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. Then a report shows some gains and some losses in the effort to clean up the Great Lakes. Writer Dale Kushner talks about her new book, The Conditions of Love.
The whole book is about an education about loving and conditions of loving, and do we give unconditional love to people, or what does that mean, or what can we expect?
And a Chicago writer explores the appeal of a Wisconsin tradition, the Supper Club.
A sense of community, and the one theme about all these things is a sense of place, you know, how important a sense of place is, a sense of belonging and stuff. You see that in a lot of these places, you know.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. There are a number of think tanks in Wisconsin that work to inform the debate that drives the state's politics. The Wisconsin Policy Research Institute, based in Heartland, often carries the reputation of tilting toward the conservative end of the spectrum. But as is the case with much of Wisconsin politics these days, it's sometimes hard to make a blanket statement about anything. In recent months, the organization has generated some thought-provoking research in areas ranging from education to economics. Since 2009, the Institute has been headed by George Lightborn, a former cabinet member under two governors. Lightborn announced his retirement earlier this year. Monday, former Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Mike Nichols will take over as president of WPRI. Nichols, who has been a senior fellow with the group for 4 years, joins us in the studio now. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What do you see as WPRI's role in the policy arena in Wisconsin? What do you hope to accomplish?
Yeah, we're a state-level think tank or public policy group. And, you know, we have a somewhat limited purview, Mitch. I mean, we focus on basically economic opportunity and sort of limited transparent government, which we think all journalists also should be interested in, and education. We've traditionally done a lot of education stuff because we just think that that's a way to make sure that everybody has equal opportunity to achieve. Those are really the three big areas, and we do a lot of other things that kind of fit into that.
Talk about the transparency element of government. I wonder how your background as a journalist influences how you approach that part of the mission.
You know what? It's what I think of as good journalists doing every day, and we're gonna do that as well. I mean, we really believe in open government. I always have. It's essential, and also we're gonna make sure that government is responsible and that it's really driven by common sense. But in some ways, we really are gonna try to act as the fourth estate always has, which is keeping an eye on government and making sure that it's accountable to the citizens.
And you have been associated with WPRI for a while now. Do you ever run into times when these other things that you're interested in, the economic issues and the various other issues, come into conflict with the transparency?
Economic issues and conflict with transparency? No. I mean, our goal is to understand what government is doing, what it does well, and what it doesn't do well. So, I mean, from my way of thinking, the more we know about what government is doing, which includes everything from contracts to how much people are making to why decisions are made, whether politics are getting in the way of good policy, that's all good from where we're coming from.
The job you're taking has been filled by George Lightborn for years.
Right.
What do you see as his lasting influence on the Institute and on Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know what? George has a whole career of influence, and he was DOA secretary actually under a couple governors, and kind of worked a long career in state government and really had a great understanding of and influence on how government works, on budgeting, on taxes, on sort of how politics is used to implement policy. George has done a couple really big things in terms of WPRI in the last 5 years. I think that's how long George was there. We did something called the Refocus Wisconsin Project, which was really big, I think maybe 3 years ago, which was a very, very involved project that basically got down to, you know, what's our quality of life here? Why aren't people as happy with it as they ought to be? How can we make this a better place? And most recently did something called Pathways to Success, which is a focus on education in Milwaukee. And I think sometimes people, you know, I think people sometimes kind of shrug, oh, my gosh, another study on education in Milwaukee. But this is a really opportune time. There are a few things going on where could really be some changes and some reform in Milwaukee, and not just in public schools. I mean, we're interested in better charter schools and better choice schools and better public schools. So George was really behind what is – you can go to our website, www.wpri.org, and look at this Pathways to Success project that's on our website. And those are the really big things. But I'm thankful to George because he's really taught me a lot and has made our magazine much better. We have a magazine at WPRI, Wisconsin Interest, that George has really revamped, and it's just been instrumental in all kinds of ways, Mitch.
The Pathways Project and the Refocus Wisconsin Project, so they are living on under your tenure?
Sure, they'll live on. We're always going to try to have an impact, again, on I think education is huge. And you know, there are a few things going on right now with education that we, you know, we had experts from, you know, nationwide come and look at Milwaukee. It's kind of a microcosm, but Milwaukee has a long history of education reform and make very specific suggestions about how this can be a better place. And again, not just in public schools, but, you know, charter schools and choice schools. And I hope the policymakers and just folks who are interested in making good decisions about where their kids go to school will look at that. George has carried on a great tradition and has a great foundation at WPRI, and you know, I have some goals as well, but I have nothing but gratitude to him for where he left the institute.
Well, and given George's background in government and your background as a journalist, right, do you see your approach as any different than what he brought to the organization?
You know, we're different people. we're different people. I don't have that government background. I have more of a journalist background. I worked at the Journal Sentinel for 18 years, and I've continued to write and syndicate a column independently of WPRI for the last 5 years. I'm going to stop doing that because I want to be able to focus on WPRI, and I kind of want to keep our focus on some specific areas, Mitch, that I was able to kind of stray away from with my with my column. But yeah, we approach things differently. And I guess it's fair to say I'm more of an outsider to government, and we'll probably take more of a journalist approach. But we're going to continue to do in-depth white papers. We hire a lot of people on a contract basis, really smart people who know more about a lot of specific issues than I do. We're going to continue to hire a lot of contractors, university professors, you know, from across the country, locally, people who know a lot about, you know, economics and education and whatnot. So we'll continue to do that, and we'll continue to do the magazine. But yeah, I am particularly interested in limited government, flexible, you know, small, open government issues. You might see a little bit more along those lines.
Well, and speaking along the lines of transparency, can you give us a sense for how the organization frames the sort of research you're going to do? How do you decide this is going to be the thrust of a white paper, for example?
Sure. I mean, well, for white papers are kind of a big deal, and they're time consuming, and frankly, they're kind of expensive. And we always, I think, want to add value in any one particular area. I mean, I just did one on what I think is a sort of a fascinating issue, and it's special education kids, and you know, what's the appropriate way to educate kids in special education? Is Wisconsin doing it the right way? Should kids be able to use special education vouchers, which actually was a topic in the budget? I mean, we don't advocate for any particular piece of legislation or not, but you know, I think the way that we make determinations is always, can we add some research and some value, some honest facts that nobody else has done before? So I just did a paper where I actually did a fairly extensive survey of private schools to see if they thought the way that funding works for special education kids, whether that works well in Wisconsin. And so can we add value in the areas that we care about?
WPRI often gets described in the media as conservative-leaning think tank.
Sure.
Do you blanch at that term? Is there a more nuanced description you think does better justice to what you're about?
No, I don't take offense. I don't take offense at us being called conservatives. I think the issues that we're interested in and that I described are traditionally of more interest to conservatives, you know, economic growth and opportunity and limited government, even education reform to some extent. But we're independent. We're nonpartisan. We really are. I don't think people understand the term. People say, oh, gosh, you can't be conservative, nonpartisan. Well, no, we're not aligned with any party. We really aren't. We don't shill for anybody. You know, we're not there to advocate. We're not a political organization. We don't lobby. We're not allowed to be. We're a 501c3. You know, we're an education organization. We want to educate people. So you know, we're not Republicans or Democrats. You can call us conservative if you want, but I hope that we're seen as a resource for anybody that's interested in the issues that I'm talking about. And the reality is, I mean, there are a lot of really important issues to people out there, all kinds of social issues. I mean, they're in the news this week, and of course I'm interested in them as an individual, but that's not our purview. I mean, the things that we're interested in, I think, are issues that are of interest to the vast majority of people, regardless of how they see themselves, liberal or Democrat or Republican or you know, conservative or whatever. But I would confess, I mean, it does kind of bother me a little bit when people just use terminology to try to pigeonhole us. I don't mind being called conservative. It's, you know, sure. But, you know, I just hope people won't use, you know, terminology and classifications as a way of avoiding thinking or confronting about honest facts and new ideas. I think that's a problem in society as a whole, not just for us at WPRI. So, you know, call us what you want, but please give our stuff a chance, because it's objective and honest. That's my argument there.
Well, and it strikes me as someone who is plugged into to venues like Facebook and Twitter that a lot of what goes on in our connections to each other as Wisconsinites and Americans is lobbying. You know, we are posting links to people who share our views in an effort to sway them. Where do you see public discourse today? Are people more entrenched than they used to be, or is the access to more information today able to have people think more before they decide?
Oh, no, sure. No, they're more entrenched, I think. And people are looking for much more so for confirmation of their own views, and that's bothersome. So what we're trying to do, what we want to do is be able to reach out to people in the middle who are just thinkers and aren't afraid of embracing or at least considering a concept, whether it's liberal or conservative, that they think is anathema to their friends or whatever their party is. But I agree with if you think that's the case, I agree with that. We've become much more entrenched, and as a society, largely because of what's happened with the internet and the media, you know, people aren't, I don't think, as open as they used to be. And they want to take a lot of intellectual shortcuts, and I think that's unfortunate.
What is your take on why this is such a purple state? Why did Wisconsin elect Tammy Baldwin and affirm Scott Walker's governorship in the same year?
Yeah, I wish I knew. You know, we're really kind of a bifurcated state in a lot of ways. I mean, in a variety of ways, and not just politically. I mean, geographically, in terms of north versus south. Gosh, you look at the economic statistics and the southern part of the state versus the north, and big cities versus smaller areas. But gosh, you look at where the really blue areas are. I mean, you know, Madison's. You know, Lee Dreyfus's old thing about, how many square miles?
Right, 20 square miles
surrounded by reality.
I've always heard the same thing about Iowa City, in fact.
You know, so, you know, Madison's a place unto itself. Obviously, the politics of the city of Milwaukee are different even than the suburbs in Milwaukee County. So a couple different things going on. And part of it is geographic in this state, where the smaller towns and outlying areas are just have different different concerns and different history than the other areas. But I mean, it is fascinating, isn't it? How can both Scott Walker and Barack Obama have positive approval ratings in the state of Wisconsin? Craig Gilbert's more of an expert on that than I am. You should ask him. But
yeah, we often hear that really politics these days is about swaying the 4% of people who are on the fence.
Exactly.
Well, Mike Nichols, I appreciate the time. Best of luck in the new position, and hope we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Mitch. I'd come back anytime. I appreciate your time, and I'll be back whenever you ask me.
Mike Nichols is the new president of the Heartland-based Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. He starts his new position on Monday. Nichols was with the Milwaukee Journal and Journal Sentinel for 18 years until leaving in 2008, and has been a senior fellow with the Institute since then. A quick break now, and then the International Joint Commission's snapshot of the state of the Great Lakes, circa 2013. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. 25 years ago, the International Joint Commission, made up of commissioners and researchers in the U.S. and Canada, was charged with monitoring the water quality of the Great Lakes and reporting back every 2 years. The commission last month issued the last of those biennial reports on the state of the health of the Great Lakes, and it offered a mixed review. John Nevin is public affairs advisor for the IJC's Great Lakes Regional Office in Windsor, Ontario, and he joined us on the line in May to shed some light on the commission's findings. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Happy to be on your show.
How would you characterize the overall health of the Great Lakes at this point in comparison to where it was in 1987 when the commission was initially charged with these biennial studies?
The health of the lakes is getting better. There are some clear indications of that, whether you look at chemical integrity, physical integrity, biological integrity. There are a number of measures that say things are getting better. But there's also a number of areas of great concern, and those in particular relate to climate change.
Well, let's look at some of these the specific indicators. There were 16 indicators that the commission studied to watch the health of the lakes. What were the areas in which the most progress has been made?
Clearly, the most progress has been made with the chemical indicators. There are a number of chemical pollutants that have experienced declines, you know, over the last 25 years. And in particular, over the sort of the first half or two-thirds of that period, we saw some fairly substantial declines, you know, whether you're looking at contaminants in the eggs of herring gulls or looking at, you know, other indicators of chemical integrity. We've seen improvements, but those improvements have kind of leveled off in recent years, and in some areas have actually seen some reversals. So there's some good news and some bad news.
Well, and so it is not entirely a success story, but to what do you attribute the general overall improving trend in terms of chemical contaminants?
I think it's an example of sort of you get that low-hanging fruit, the sort of the least costliest reductions are gained early in the process, and then it becomes more and more expensive over time to gain the reduction. So that's, I think, an indicator of that. And you also have we're seeing more and more, I think, you know, just look at the weather recently. We're seeing more and more evidence of climate change, and there are interactions between climate and these other indicators. So, for example, you have interactions between warmer water and the incidence of invasive species. So, you know, the conditions are changing, so we have to have more research and a lot more work on understanding the Great Lakes so that we can keep on making them cleaner.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the other indicators that have gotten a bit worse, including the disappearance of this tiny shrimp-like organism called Diporia. What is the significance of that within the ecosystem?
The significance of that is it's a food source at the bottom of the food chain for the kind of fish that we really appreciate, especially Milwaukee, you know, perch. You know, they need that to thrive and to do well in Lake Michigan. And because we believe of the kind of spread of invasive mussels, we've now seen the disappearance of this Diporia. It's a really big concern. It's like pulling the rug out of the bottom of the food chain.
At the same time, you do report some progress on invasive species, most specifically as a result of ballast water discharges.
Sure.
Are ballast water issues behind us in the Great Lakes?
Oh, by no means. The ballast water is still a concern because right now we have we've had in place regulations for a number of years in which the ocean-going vessels must do what they call kind of a swish and spit. They have to put salt water in their tanks and swish that around before they can get into the Great Lakes system. And that apparently has helped in that we haven't found a new invader attributed to ballast water since 2006. But on the other hand, we have other scientists telling us that we haven't found one just because we haven't been looking hard enough. There's always we can't be too vigilant in protecting the Great Lakes from invasive species. It looks like the door might be closing. It might not be shut. But we still have work to do when it comes to invasive species.
And ballast water is not the only way which invasive species can get into the Great Lakes.
Right, right. I mean, obviously, the biggest concern right now is Asian carp. You know, we found, you know, the scientists have found the remnants of DNA, you know, the eDNA of carp in the lakes, but they haven't actually found a carp. And so there's some disagreement of whether carp are in the lakes or not in the lakes. So it's a big concern of both the governments, and they've been very aggressive in trying to put together a strategy to keep them out.
You mentioned climate change, and you write about a general area you call physical integrity, which includes water temperatures and ice cover. What is the general story in that area?
The general story is that water is getting warmer. You know, on the one hand, that if you live around Lake Superior, that's probably good news. You can swim, you know, in months other than August.
You know?
And you know, my mom lives up in the North Woods, up in Rhinelander, and she had ice on the lake up until just a week ago. So you know, warming water can be good for tourism, but it's a challenge for the species that live in the lake. So we've, you know, looking at the period that was covered in the report, and that we've seen maybe as much as a degree and a half or 2 degree increase in water temperature, and what that affects is the amount of ice. As temperatures go up, we get less ice in the wintertime, and you get more evaporation, and that means levels are lower because the water is warmer.
You mentioned the idea of reducing chemical contaminants as potentially being the low-hanging fruit. I would imagine that something like climate issues are on the other end of the chain. It's one thing to deal with, say, point source pollution, but climate is truly a global issue.
It is a global issue. I mean, there's not something that one person living in Milwaukee or Racine can do to kind of arrest the march of climate change. I mean, everybody has a role to play, but it's something that there are our city, state, federal governments, and internationally needs to be dealt with. It is not low hanging fruit. It's definitely the big question and challenge that's facing the lakes. And for example, and I talked a minute ago about the interactions across these different challenges. If you look at, say, Lake Erie, climate change is really posing a challenge too, because it's increasing the incidence of harmful algae. Because we've had these scientists tell us we're going to see more intense rainstorms, and obviously we've had that this spring. And more intense rain means more runoff and more nutrients flushed into our lakes. And so scientists are telling us that we'll probably see one of the worst algae blooms ever, potentially in Lake Erie this year. So that shows the interaction across the different challenges.
Well, and one of the other points that was really interesting that this report makes is the need for a larger set of environmental indicators that can be agreed on. I wonder, does that speak to the conflicting pressures facing both governments when it comes to Great Lakes stewardship?
Yeah, actually, just to be clear, we actually want a smaller set.
Okay.
The report didn't leave that implication, because there are hundreds of different indicators, whether it's the number of mayflies per square meter, or the diaporia that we talked about earlier on the floor of Lake Michigan, and temperature or ice cover. And if you look across, policymakers can't make decisions based on hundreds of indicators. We need a small set of indicators that can really give a good sense of are the lakes getting cleaner or not. And what our commission is doing is we're working with scientists both in universities and in governments to come up with a small set of maybe a couple dozen indicators of both human health and ecosystem health, and tie those directly to the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement that the two countries have, so that we can see that if we take action X, we get result Y, and that's reflected in the indicator. And a lot of scientists, have their favorite indicator because that's their area of research, but that might not be the most helpful indicator for a policymaker, say, at the Environmental Protection Agency, when they have to make a decision about a regulatory change.
Well, so then what are you hoping that the overall takeaway message will be for the U.S. and Canadian state and provincial governments with a stake in the health of the Great Lakes?
I think the biggest takeaway is research is critically important. And a lot of times when we have budget challenges, the first act kind of falls on research and monitoring. And what we're saying in this report is that in this time, especially with climate change, we need to be spending more on research and monitoring, not less, so that policymakers can make decisions based on the best information. Because otherwise, we really don't know what's happening in the Great Lakes. You can look out over Lake Michigan, and there's just there's so many different forces that are acting on the lakes. And the more we can do to understand them, then we can make decisions to help them.
Well, and if I understand correctly, was this the last of the biennial reports the commission was to issue as a result of the 1987 agreement? Is that right?
That's exactly right. This is the last under the 25 years of the past agreement. The two countries got together last year and signed a new agreement that just came into effect a couple of months ago. So going forward, the good news is that the two countries have, with this new agreement, have agreed to redouble their efforts to focus on cleaning up the lakes and to really be more accountable to the people in both countries and making sure that we connect with the various stakeholder groups and organizations throughout the Great Lakes and say, what are you looking for? What are the things that you expect from the governments to do in cleaning up the lakes? and to build a better kind of communication across the border and to work together to clean them up.
Does that mean there will be another report due out in 2015, or is the study going to take another form from here on out?
It's actually going to be on a three-year cycle this time around. So we're going to work on the governments have committed to doing a really comprehensive assessment on the health of the Great Lakes. And so the next report will come out in 2016.
John Nevin, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
John Nevin is the Public Affairs Advisor for the International Joint Commission's Great Lakes Regional Office in Windsor, Ontario. He talked with us in May about the IJC's report on the water quality in the Great Lakes. You will find a link to that report from WUWM.com. Another break now, and then we'll meet writer Dale Kushner. Her new novel is called The Conditions of Love. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The legend goes that the Eskimos have dozens of words for snow. Well, Madison author Dale Kushner thinks we should have more than one word for love in the English language. Her debut novel, The Conditions of Love, explores the many iterations of love from the perspective of the young protagonist, Eunice. As she struggles to discern what love is all about, she learns about the depths and limits of familial love, the importance of friendship and mentoring, and about passion, desire, devotion, and loyalty. Kushner tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce, the book is written in three parts, the first of which focuses on Eunice's unique relationship with her mother, Myrne.
You know, one of the things that we all struggle with, and Eunice is struggling with in the first part of the novel, is this relationship with her mother, which is very intimate, very, very profound, but also her mother is, quote, a misfit. So she's also trying to separate from her mother, which is, of course, the goal of all of us. We have to separate from our parents. So she both adores her mother, who's a larger-than-life figure, but also resents her and also is trying to figure out her own identity. So you would hear a little bit of the mimicking, but as the novel progresses, you see that she develops her own voice.
And part of that comes as a reaction to her mother's relationships, her mother's own search for love, except when it's right in front of her, she doesn't seem to want it.
She doesn't seem to want it because she doesn't really know what love is. I mean, one of the aspects of the mother in this story is that she has an unfulfilled creative life. The novel's set in the 50s, and in the 50s, Hollywood was this place of pure enchantment. The mother, Myrne, has a fantasy life, a creative life about becoming a movie star. Well, if you're a movie star, the men that are going to flock to you are other movie stars. So she's always waiting for this sort of perfect lover, as in Clark Gable or Cary Grant. And so she can't really see what's in front of her. And this is not lost on the daughter.
I think that's especially clear when we see Eunice's dad come back into the picture ever so briefly, followed by the introduction of Sam Podesta.
Sam. Yes. Mm-hmm.
For Eunice, what do these two men represent?
Frankie is the charmer. Frankie is her father. He abandoned the family at birth. He's this charismatic man who becomes idealized because he's been absent for the first 10 years of her life. And he has that, you know, he has that bewitching blend. He carries that bewitching blend of charm and deceit, which is very alluring for a lot of women, including her mother. So he's that kind of man, the kind of man you would sort of drool over, but you know you're going to get your heart broken. Sam is a sort of a maternal figure. He's a stabilizing figure to some degree. He literally provides their groceries. He seems to be somewhat worldly, but he's also, the main thing about Sam is he's dependable, and she really knows he loves her. So again, these are facets of love that she's learning. The whole book is about an education about loving and conditions of loving, and do we give unconditional love to people, or what does that mean, or what can we expect?
Compare the mourning for us that Eunice goes through when it comes to having her father walk out on her a second time, having Sam Podesta leave her mother after Myrne rejects him, and mm-hmm. even losing Myrne as we get into the second part of the book.
The book is about loss. I mean, as a broad theme, the book is about how do we survive not only difficult beginnings. I mean, I often say Eunice was born under a dark star, but the challenges that face us along the way. And as much as we might want to sort of deny it, loss is part of living. Loss is part of the human condition. And Eunice gets a big wallop of it early on. It shapes her. And in my mind, she's a real heroine because she keeps her heart open and she doesn't become bitter. She doesn't seek revenge. She continues to love. So loss and love are very intertwined. And the wages of love often are that, you know, the more you love someone, the harder it is when you lose them. But do you choose not to love? I mean, that's a question I think we all face many, many times. You know, I just add on this. Someone asked me, who would want to read your novel? I mean, they asked me in a fun way. And I said, I'll have to think about that. And then I thought, well, anyone who's been in love, anyone who wants to be in love, anyone who's been knocked around by love, anyone who's been enchanted by love, because I think love is the strongest force in the universe and the most, you know, life-changing form. So
from the first part of the book into the second part of the book, you introduce this almost biblical flood that comes to the town Turtle Lake where Myrne has taken Eunice to kind of start her life over again after Sam Podesta has left them. What does this flood metaphorically, if you will, wash away and also wash into Eunice's life?
Well, obviously, floods are pretty mythic images, and we know them, from the Bible and even before the Judaic Christian Bible, there are Noah stories and other traditions. It is a washing away. It's also sometimes I believe crises give us the push to make choices, decisions, difficult decisions that we might not otherwise make. So in the situation of the flood, Eunice has been really wanting to separate from her mother, leave her mother in a way. And the flood gives her an opportunity, a physical opportunity to, well, she thinks she's going to go out in the flood and get help and rescue her mother. But in fact, it separates them. So it's a real transition, as these kinds of things are. If we think in reality, not metaphorically, about natural disasters, if we followed the stories of the people on the ground, whether it was a tornado or a flood or an earthquake, we might see that right afterwards there would be these big decisions that happen to families. So it is both metaphoric and literal in that sense. And it washes her into the next phase of education with a character named Rose.
Tell us a little bit about Rose and what she manages to give Eunice that she never could have gotten from Myrne.
You know, I've often, for people who haven't read the book, Rose is a kind of hermitess figure who lives in the woods, and she may seem very archetypal and mythical, and she is in a way, but she's also real because there are people, especially in Wisconsin and Minnesota and up north, these very strong woodswomen. So she has a reality to her. She provides Eunice with an understanding of friendship, with an understanding of loyalty, and also with a whole education about relationship to the natural world. So what I was going to say is sometimes if you don't get, quote, the right mother in real life, there's always Mother Nature. And I think that Rose represents something of that and introduces Eunice to an understanding and love of the natural world, which she was beginning to discover when she was with Myrne.
How is Eunice changing as we see her gain this appreciation for nature, gain a trade as she learns how to beekeep with Rose. How is she changing at this point in the story?
Well, one thing is she's learning how to live without her mother. She's learning she can live without her mother. And Rose, too, everybody in the novel, every character has a backstory about love. So she also learns from Rose, who seems, you know, so heroic, that Rose, in fact, has a backstory about love that's tragic and dark. So she learns from Rose that there's no perfection, really, in love, that love has many facets. And that, too, helps her to navigate what's ahead for her.
In the third part of the book, what sort of challenge is Eunice face? I mean, it seems like she's beginning to learn about a new kind of love.
She's learning about desire because she's a young woman and she has desire. And so everything that has come before her, the family, love of family, attachment to the parent surrogates, friendship, devotion, will now become part of her life in a new way with a man called Fox. And there's some tragedy ahead for both of them. But as she's learning and involved in this erotic relationship, really, she's also becomes an artist. She, all along in the book, she draws. That's one of the ways that her imagination works. And so from the beginning, there's sort of an elliptical pattern. She comes from a mother who has frustrated creativity, and in the end, she becomes an artist. And that's tied in with this man who sees that in her, who mirrors that in her, who feeds that in her. And so that's part of what she's learning in that last part.
Does Eunice ever really get a handle on how to deal with loss as it's related to love? How did her previous experiences prepare her for what she deals with Fox?
You know, I see her as someone who both suffers the loss, that is, she's not in denial, she doesn't put it into her work. I mean, all the many, many ways that we all try to avoid things that are painful, she kind of metabolizes it. She recognizes it. She cries. She may have, when she's younger, a way that she works it out through her imagination. But then she moves on. She cultivates things that bring her joy. She has an enormous sense of curiosity about life. She has an enormous sense of wonder, you know, especially the section of Rose when she's learning about the natural world. And I think that's the marker, I often think, of those who survive difficulties, loss, suffering, tragedy. They don't get stuck in the past. The past can, I mean, I think Sam says the past can haunt you if you let it. And she recognizes the past without getting stuck in it. So for readers reading this, I think if you notice how she does that and how she metabolizes and integrates the things that happened to her, that's how she survives. You know, I think the thing about reading in general, and especially novels like The Conditions of Love, is that the reader gets to be with the characters over time. They get to see the characters develop over time, versus just, you know, a short span of their life. So that was an impetus to make this novel about Eunice's whole life, precisely for the questions you're asking, you know, are about that. You know, how does she survive? What drives her? When I started the novel, I didn't really know. I was just driven by finding out. And I'm curious about people's lives. And there are no set answers, you know.
Well, Dale Kushner, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Dale Kushner's novel is called The Conditions of Love. Kushner, who lives in Madison, has received numerous awards, residencies, and honors, and is also author of the recent poetry collection, More Alive Than Lions Roaring. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. You can learn more about her and her book group appearances at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then we'll explore the uniquely Midwest phenomenon of supper clubs. It's Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's a Friday night, or it will be in a few hours, and you're looking for a place to eat. Someplace you want to escape to, have a nice filling meal, maybe a refreshing drink or two, and some conversation. But fast food or a lively chain restaurant just doesn't sound like it will fit the bill. The Wisconsin solution might be a supper club, known for their Friday night fish fries, Saturday night steak dinners, full bar, linen napkins, and dim lighting. They're a temporary escape into the past. There's often entertainment of some kind, making a meal, maybe into an all-night affair. Certainly, there is no room for dine and dash. Chicago Sun-Times writer Dave Hoekstra ate at these places while traveling around the Midwest looking for the next story and his next meal. He felt it was time to write about these Midwest treasures, and in his newest book, The Supper Club Book, he features many of those at which he ate. Hoekstra sat down with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson, not in the Lake Effect studios, but in Madison at one of the supper clubs he profiles.
We're at Smokey's in Great Supper Club / Steakhouse in Madison, Wisconsin.
Now, why here?
Well, it's in the book. It's in the book. It's a legendary place, and they're having an anniversary party tonight as well, I believe. They tied in the book release party with their anniversary party.
Again, in your newest book, The Supper Club, which just came out recently, you feature select supper clubs from Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and one or two in Michigan. What is a supper club?
I started this as part of my travel columns at the Sun-Times, and I would just have a little checklist. It was kind of just kind of tongue-in-cheek for fun, and I would just walk around and with my little criteria, you know. So in this place, I mean, a Friday night fish fry, you know, prime rib on Saturday. Supper clubs have linen napkins, you know. These days that's kind of cost prohibitive, but that's a thing of a good supper club. A great relish tray. It's some stuff like that here tonight. Maybe a little out of style. Lazy Susan is a good thing of a supper club. Dim lighting. Smokey's has dim lighting. Dead fish on the wall, stuffed fish, stuff like that. A lot of them have, when you're driving around, you know, just a scenic view, a nice rural, like, woods, lake view, you know, good neon. It's a cheap escape, you know.
What is the concept of a supper club? Is it more focused on the food or of the ambiance or a little of both?
Little of both. I think back in the day, maybe in the 40s and 1950s, I would always ask people where the club term came from, and nobody really had a definitive answer for that. But in the 40s and 50s, when the drinking laws were a little looser and stuff, people would come to a club, a supper club, as early as 4 or 5 o'clock, you know, supper time, supper being a rural term. And they'd have a couple drinks and stuff. Then they would adjourn to the dining room, you know, have a nice leisurely dinner, you know, look out at that scenic view I was just talking about. Then they'd come back in the lounge and hear live music and have a couple more, you know, it'd be like a 6 or 7 hour night. You know, they have 4 or 5 cocktails. And two things have happened. I mean, the DUI laws as well as it's more expensive to have live entertainment. You know, some supper clubs still have a piano player, a little trio and stuff. But club, I think, was just like a clubby destination to get away to.
So getting away to it, looking at your map that you feature in the book, a lot of the locations, which happen to be in either Minnesota or Wisconsin, are following 94. Were they really located by interstates, or were they kind of just off the road, or were they more or less hidden?
That's a good question. Maybe the interstates built around them. You know, there's in Iowa, the ones I have in Iowa are on the old Lincoln Highway, which actually celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. And, you know, that was a big route. And, again, maybe some of the club name or these were speakeasies. And, you know, there's one in Cedar Rapids they have where Capone and Dillinger would stop in there on their runs, you know, back to Chicago and stuff. And they have, like, a little one of those little one-eyed window things you look out. And, you know, its roots are in the speakeasy, which a little bit of the club thing comes from. So, yeah, I think the rural two-laners, you know, gave birth to these.
You also touch on the history of the individual supper clubs. When did they start, though? Where did they start?
Well, the first one, actually, it's in the foreword of the book. I don't know the exact date, but it was in the 1930s, and it was actually in L.A., but it was started by a Wisconsin guy.
A Wisconsinite.
Yeah, right, yeah. And he started a supper club in Los Angeles. But, you know, they just grew up around, you know, the rural Midwest and developed there, you know, the farm families and things like that. And now they're being kind of reformed and reconfigured. I've got some newer supper clubs in the book, like the old-fashioned in Madison, which is run by young people, and they're very green, very farm-to-table type stuff. They shop at the farmer's market there at the Capitol and stuff. But they use the White Stag up by Rhinelander as a template. They grew up around there. So they're using their memories and putting them into a play in a very, very trendy and popular restaurant.
What are the, who are the kind of people who go into this business? Are they going to be the farm rural types? Are they the newer types like you were talking about?
Definitely all independent, definitely family. You know, a lot of, I've met a lot of like second and third generation people. Here is like second or third generation right here at Smokey. No chains. There's no chains in the book, you know. Or people who are starting anew, but again, have the supper club memories they draw from. There's one in downtown Detroit that's the only one in Michigan in the book, Cliff Bell's. I mean, there are a bunch of 30-year-olds who are taking like an old supper club right in downtown Detroit, in a really rough area downtown Detroit. And they're using, you know, like things like the Green Mill in Chicago as a template for their design. And they're bringing in live jazz. And so it's really, to me, it's really exciting as it kind of morphs. And people go, a supper club is going to be dead. I think it's almost like when we talk about Route 66 and stuff, you know, nothing's ever set in one place. Route 66 always evolves, and these supper clubs are always going to be evolving. They'll always be around in some form.
So supper clubs are found around the entire nation, not just the Midwest, or are there more?
Well, again, as time moves on, people, like, use the term loosely. You know, this last summer I was in Harlem, and I went to a great, they called it a supper club. It was in the basement of a jazz club, and they called it a supper club, and they had, they didn't have anything like, you know, a Friday night fish fry or prime rib, you know, but they had like sophisticated drinks. They had live jazz and stuff. And around Chicago, I know there's groups of people who have like supper clubs on Sunday night at their house. And what it is just that they hire a great chef and they cook privately and stuff. And they call that a supper club. So, you know, the name's being twisted around and changed around. That's cool. You know, it's kind of a catchy name. It keeps it alive. You know?
It does, yeah. The little piece of nostalgia.
I'm not, you know, I don't have any ownership to one particular kind of supper club. You know, I mean, it's great. You know?
So with you traveling around the Midwest, especially for this book, you've met a couple of interesting characters, at least that stood out to me, like Marge and Cosette.
Yeah.
Who really stood out to you?
That's what steered the book, you know. I mean, I it's not a book of recipes. I'm not a food critic, you know. I didn't eat that much at these places. You know, I had a couple of beers. I had my first old-fashioned doing this book. I never had old-fashioned.
Did you have it at old-fashioned?
No, you know what? I had it at Mr. Ed's TV. Oh. Ed Thompson. It was a great story. He's since passed away, but he's the brother of Tommy Thompson. Former governor.
Yeah.
And they had a great old-fashioned there. I was telling John here about it. It's like, you know, brandy old-fashioned with a little cinnamon stick in it. It was really, really nice. They claim it's the best old-fashioned in the state. So, yeah, the stories are really what kind of steered the book. I don't know. I didn't know. When I started writing about supper clubs for the Sun-Times, I just was, like, into that whole quick escape thing I was talking about, you know. And then the more I researched this book, it took 3 summers. It's just, like, little, you know, the oral histories, like WPA guides and stuff, you know. And so, like, again, we're here at Smokey's. They have Ozzy, the dishwasher, who they came on board in 1964 and gradually lost his eyesight over the years, and they keep him on board. He still washes dishes even though he can't see, like, a couple nights a week. And what that does, that underscores the sense of community. And the one theme about all these things is the sense of place, you know, how important sense of place is. And this is a place for him to go, you know, and a sense of belonging and stuff. You see that in a lot of these places, you know.
Another interesting thing about the Supper Club book that I found is you were featuring the different supper clubs, and one of them was called the Hobnob. And what really surprised me were the big names that frequented the restaurant, such as Frank Lloyd Wright and Walt Disney. Who are the kinds of people who are coming in? Who are they aiming to serve?
I think it was families, you know. I mean, there's one in there, the Dell Bar in Wisconsin Dells, that was designed by one of Wright's students. And that was so close to, you know, Spring Green and all that type of stuff. But I think it was mostly, like, you know, families. One thing I found after the book came out, or as I was working on the book, I heard a lot of, you know, a lot of people from Chicago. Their parents had, like, summer cottages and stuff in Wisconsin. So that's where their supper club memories come from, is, like, spending summers up there and going out to a different supper club on Friday night for the fish fry and things like that. You know, Wright was working on the factories there in Racine, so I think that's why he came in there and stuff like that. But I think it's mostly a family clientele.
So what is the future of supper clubs? Are they going to be staying around, or are they going to start kind of dying off?
For the most part, I think they'll be around, and, you know, young people taking them over. And there's one in the book, the first chapter, Turks Inn, okay? That's in Hayward, Wisconsin. It's one of the oldest supper clubs in the state. And that woman ran it by herself, 85 years old. She just died a couple months ago. And when I interviewed her, she said I'm glad I captured her history and stuff, but she said when she died, she didn't want it to stay open. She had no family and stuff, so it, you know, kind of fallen on hard times the last few years and stuff, but that's the only one in the book that's not there. They're closed right now, but that was a rare case. So many of them are just, like, you know, family run.
If somebody has never been to a supper club, where would be one of the places you would recommend for a new person to start trying supper clubs?
Well, I do like the Hobnob. You mentioned the Hobnob. That's close to Chicago, and I believe, and somebody have to prove me wrong, it's the only supper club that's right on Lake Michigan. You know, the bar actually has a great shot of Lake Michigan. You go, there's a little patio you can do Lake Michigan. I mean, a lot of these places, you know, like creeks and rivers, but the Hobnob's right on Lake Michigan. Great, I talked about great neon, and great photo ops at the great neon at the Hobnob. I like the name, you know, you're hobnobbing. Again, for Wisconsin, Ishnala, you know. Ishnala is over by the Wisconsin Dells. It's like a little northwest of the Wisconsin Dells, and it's seasonal. It opens around Memorial Day, and I think it closes in early October. And I'm sure it's the only supper club in Wisconsin. It's in a state park. I mean, you go there on a busy Friday night, you could probably rent a canoe while you wait for your table, you know. And there's a little lake. You have to look in the book, Mirror Lake. Anyway, the supper club overlooks this lake. It's just, it's really, really nice. So those are two good starters.
Great. Well, thanks, Dave Hoekstra.
I'm very impressed you came all the way to Madison for this.
All right. Well, okay, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
Dave Hoekstra's newest book, The Supper Club Book, was released earlier this month. He's been a writer with the Chicago Sun-Times since 1985 and has won a number of key awards. He lives in Chicago and loves Greek diners, especially the Golden Apple. He spoke with Eleanor Peterson inside the supper club called Smokey's Club in Madison. That's another week's worth of Lake Effect. Before we go, just a reminder that in the final days of WUWM's fiscal year, we're inviting you to make a contribution before Sunday. It's your chance to win the Radiolab Live VIP package, including two exclusive balcony box seats to the live show at the Riverside Theater on Friday, October 11th, a special pre-show rehearsal and meet and greet with Robert Krulwich and Jad Abramod, and much more. Make your year-end contribution today at WUWM.com/give or call us now at 414-270-1225 with your support and for your chance to win. Thanks so much. We're produced by Bonnie North, Stephanie Lecce, and Dan Harmon with support from Amy Kiley, Eleanor Peterson, Rachel Bloom, Nathan Royster, and Gabby Magianis. John Strelecki is our studio engineer. I'm Mitch Tyke. Have a great weekend, and I hope you'll make us a part of it. Join us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.